The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Bjorkman, and Judge Halbrooks. The Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals Zoom session this ninth day of January 2024. We have four arguments on the calendar this morning. The first is in the matter of the civil commitment of Johnson, file A231506. I don't know if the attorneys are familiar with our Zoom protocol. The same rules apply, 15 minutes for each party, 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. Please be mindful of the judge's attempts to interrupt you for questioning. They may wave, they may use the raised hand emblem. Also note the timing mechanism. And for the record, we are recording this. It will be available as an audio recording. No other recordings are allowed of these proceedings. And with that, we're ready to hear from counsel for appellant in the first case.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Crystal Linney on behalf of the appellant, and if it pleases the court, we're here today to discuss what I think are some interesting issues that were raised in the civil commitment procedure regarding sexually dangerous persons or sexually psychopathic personalities. As noted in my brief, my client is transgender. So while the name of my client is Christopher Johnson, I will be referring to her with the pronouns of her and she. I think to start off, one of the things that I just wanted to address really quickly, I think it was addressed in my brief, is when we talked to the first issue about the exhibits and the question of prejudice. Well, what's the prejudice? The appellant can't list the prejudice to her. And I said, the problem with all of this and how it happened is the prejudice is unfortunately unknown, because I would love to be able to sit here to court and be able to say, well, the issue is they didn't receive pages 1109 to 1123 of Exhibit 10. And those pages contained just important documentation that the court needed that could have changed everything. I can't do that because the biggest issue and the worst issue is unknown. I don't know what the court received.
Counsel, how can it be that you don't know what the court received? Whatever, I'm assuming that whatever the court received is part of the record and is available to you in preparation for this appeal. So I'm very confused by your statement that you have no idea what was in the exhibits that were received by the court.
The record was sealed, Your Honor. So I've never received what was submitted to the court in Exhibit 10.
Are you telling me the record was sealed and you were not allowed to access it?
That is correct, Your Honor. We tried to correct some of that and get some of those records to us, but Exhibit 10 has never been provided to me.
And what was Exhibit 10?
Exhibit 10 is the DOC records, the Department of the Department of Corrections records. So it's about 3,000 pages.
Just to make sure we're on the same page, as I understand it, everything that was received was disclosed to you originally.
So I have the original documents, about 3,000 pages of Exhibit 10 that was received to me.
And you stipulated to the admission of how many documents?
I stipulated to the admission of the documents if they were unchanged and if they match what were provided to me. What I was later told is that the documents that were provided to me had parts removed.
All right. And as I understand it, the district court itself raised this issue and said, I'm looking at these submissions. There seem to be fewer documents than that were originally listed. And that was discussed at a hearing. You were present at the hearing. What did you do to say, I can't go forward with my stipulation? I need to know exactly what's in those documents.
That all happened after the trial, Your Honor. So basically, we had trial, we stipulated to these documents, then after the fact, like about a month or so later, I think, when the court was reviewing it, that's when it was brought up, it was the court admin who brought up, hey, there seems to be a disconnect here, because we have what you provided in your witness and exhibit list and the index, and that doesn't match what was provided. And at that point, I said, wait, what's going on? What was provided? I don't know anything about this. So
okay,
all of that happened after trial.
Did you raise that in your new trial motion?
I did, Your Honor.
And what was the district court's response?
I think the district court's response is because I couldn't tell them what the court received and how it prejudiced them, that it was denied. And I said, my biggest argument with that is that I can't tell you what you didn't receive and how it prejudiced you because I don't know what you received and I don't know how what you received is different from what I have.
Okay, did
And
you
that was
tell
my
the
point.
court you weren't being provided access to the exhibits that had been received?
Yes, I do believe I told the court that I did not receive access to those documents, particularly Exhibit 10.
But it's my understanding from the record that in fact the respondents' counsel provided a document index that in fact listed the items that had been removed from the 1300 pages of submission, so that in fact you were aware of what was not submitted. Am I wrong about that?
Except for I can't confirm if that's actually accurate. They say, hey, you can tell what it was. But when you're removing hundreds of pages of documents, I don't know if that in fact is accurate and that they accidentally removed something else that they didn't mean to. And I
Can you
know at
please?
one point they said it was, well, it's just duplicate, and that's what they were arguing. But then another argument, they said, well, we believe that this part isn't substantive, so we removed that as well. And I'm just like, wait, so what?
Let me ask you this. Even let's assume we agree with you that this should have all been disclosed. How does it, given your stipulation that your client qualifies or meets the statute criteria to be committed as a, or to met the statutory criteria to be considered a sexually dangerous person, what difference does all of this make?
I think what it really kind of goes down to is it addresses some of the facts that possibly are that we're contesting. I don't know. But I think it also goes into when you look at the whole record as a whole, it might impact really the whole concept of what is available to my client. And so I think that's kind of
Oh, go ahead. You'll finish, please.
and so I think that's really what it kind of goes down to is in some of these, like case in point, and I think it's part of it. Like one of my biggest arguments is if you look at the exhibits, one of the exhibits flat out discusses my client applying for after May 2021, applying for sex offender treatment and then being denied and then and basically saying that that was because, well, we know there's a commitment coming, so we're not, so that's why. And I presume that was one of them. It should have been included. I hope it's included, but I guess I haven't been able to confirm that that page, that document was
But
included.
counsel, let me follow up on Judge Bergman's question. If your client stipulated that she meets the criteria for commitment as a sexually dangerous person, that's the fact at issue. So that's already been decided. So what were you possibly contesting? Did you actually stipulate that she meets the criteria and then argue she didn't?
No, so we did stipulate, and that was based on not so much the records, that was based upon the two the findings from the examiners. And so what that really comes down to is what you can find in the documents is one,
Okay,
it
so
goes to
counsel,
the
let me follow up because I have a lot of questions. This is a very confusing argument to me. You stipulated to the omission of certain documents. You're not arguing that the court received something to which you did not stipulate in terms of the documents.
I am arguing when I stipulated, I said those had to remain unchanged. They had to match what was provided to us, that full 3,000 and some odd page of Exhibit 10.
So your
That's very
complaint
specific what
is
I stipulated to.
the judge didn't receive all the documents that you thought the judge should have. But what does that matter if the conclusion was foregone that your client met the criteria for commitment?
Because it matters in regards to one, some of the specific findings, two, regarding some of the issues about what they alleged on regarding her treatment efforts. Three, it goes into, like I said, very importantly, the matter of the matter of whether or not she was denied treatment. And so that's where it kind of goes into. One of our arguments is that she was in fact denied treatment because of the commitment process.
Understood.
And
Two
so
more
I hope.
questions before you transition into another argument. When you made the stipulation to the document, did you include any conditions on your stipulation other than it's got to be the same documents in the same condition?
That was the only condition I made when
Okay.
I put
So
that in there.
you didn't say, and these documents can only be used for this purpose and no other purpose. And you didn't say, and to the extent the documents contain hearsay, you can't consider the hearsay. I mean, you
No,
put
no.
in all these documents for the judge, and the judge made findings based on those documents. I'm having a hard time understanding how you can be complaining about hearsay in the documents, that the documents weren't reliable, that allegations in a police report can't be taken at face value when you didn't impose any of those conditions on the stipulation. Normally in court proceedings, when you stipulate to a document without any condition, it's evidence that can be used as the fact finder sees fit to use it. And there's case law that says that.
And I think that kind of goes into that, especially in this case. It's not as strict. I'm not as stringent on it when it's a judge, because judges are the ones who are able to determine that. And usually you hope they use their best judgment to determine, okay, so we're basically saying mother is saying this. And that's kind of one of our issues, is that this really all comes from the mother. And knowing what they all
His
say about the mother.
Convictions come from the mother. I mean, I'm having a hard time seeing any prejudice in this case, given that your client stipulated that she meets the criteria for sexually dangerous person, stipulated to the admission of thousands of documents that would allow the court to find that she met the criteria. Because I do think we'd have a problem if a person stipulated that they met the criteria for commitment and then there was no record that could actually support that, sort of like a guilty plea. You need to have something in the record to support it. But I just don't understand how you're making these arguments at this point. And where in the record would we look to see that you complain that the record was sealed such that you did not have access to it? And you don't have to answer now, but perhaps you can answer that on rebuttal. And
okay.
Please go on with your other arguments. I know you have some constitutional arguments as well.
So I just wanted to go on very quickly to my other arguments. Since I only have 5 minutes left. So one regarding the less restrictive means. So one of the arguments that was made by the state is that they asserted that the program wasn't available to my client because she failed to reapply and so it wasn't open. That's actually not what was stated at all. Basically, what was stated by Ms. Ortman, and really what was provided by Exhibit 10, as provided it was all there, is that no, because of the commitment process, and they don't treat committed people, sex offenders in prison, that's why she was denied. And so, and that kind of goes back to the whole point, is that,
okay.
Wait
so
a
let
second.
Let me stop you there. My question on that point is, what do you say to the fact that seems to presume your client had a right to sex offender treatment while in prison? And we have a statute that says there is no right to treatment while in prison.
And I don't know if you're referring to the statute that the state cited. That statute's only for interim confinement, Your Honor. And it's not like, so once the person is committed and before you have the commitment process, really. So that statute also says, oh, by the way, refer to this other statute that says prisons have to have sex offender treatment programs. And then once a person is actually committed, that changes. And so that's only in the terms of interim commitment while the process is going forward and you're trying to determine they're committed. When the person is actually committed, they have statutorily and constitutionally a right to be committed.
But the period of time you're describing is prior to commitment.
Exactly. And so you
so
have this kind of
what you just explained, that statute applies during the interim proceedings, but not after commitment.
Well, and then, but even, I'm sorry,
you're talking about pre-commitment.
I'm talking about pre-commitment, and but that statute also basically says, but this it needs to be read in correlation to that, and I believe it's like 244, and that 244 basically says prisons need to have sex offenders.
Did you cite all of this in your brief? Because I don't recall seeing statutory citations to walk us through this in your brief.
No, I don't believe because I didn't file a reply brief, Your Honor, because when I was going through, most of what they had was basically just I'd already addressed. I think that's the
but
one
you're
thing
making
that,
constitutional arguments based on your interpretation or your reading of statutes, and you haven't even cited those statutes in your brief.
Some of those statutes, the statutes that that say they are allowed treatment, especially once committed, and that's one of the biggest issues, is yes, indeed. And in fact, some of this happened before there was a commitment process, before there was an interim order holding her to be stayed. Well, then as well, she was allowed to be treated. And so and those statutes that basically say, yes, they have a right to treatment once you're committed. I did cite those in my brief.
Even assuming we agree with you that there is a statute or some sort of a constitutional or statutory right to treatment, I find it hard on this record to find that treatment was ever denied. I mean, it seems to me that your client had at least 9 opportunities to engage in treatment, including at Lino Lakes in the time frame leading up to what would have been her release date.
So there's a difference between, and that's why I point out, a treatment outside of prison and a treatment inside of prison. And basically what happened was after she was, after the second time when she was removed in May 2021, the record does clearly show in a HRU hearing that she applied, was denied. And that was because they were considering committing her. And so I think
that she also had 2 violations. Wasn't she terminated or discharged from treatment twice for 2 different reasons?
Yeah,
two different
she was.
Violations of the program?
Yes, she was, and they told her that they would still be willing to work with her, and all she needed to do was reapply. But when she did reapply, they basically said, oh, well, they're looking at a commitment, so we're not going to treat you.
Didn't she wait to reapply until 2023?
No, the Exhibit 10, the HRU hearing results specifically said that, no, she applied after May 2021, shortly thereafter, and was denied because of the commitment, because the state was looking into a commitment. They hadn't actually brought anything or started a commitment process or asked her to be held for anything, but they were informed that they were looking into it. And so that's why she was denied.
Your time is up. You do have 5 minutes on rebuttal. Would you please see if you could find for us a citation to the record showing that you raised the issue of being denied access to the record in this case because it was sealed?
And now sure.
We'll hear from counsel for the respondent. Would you state your name for the record and please begin your argument?
Thank you. Good morning. Yes. Lisa Jones, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Renville County, in this matter. Appellant has raised many issues in her appeal. The response to all of those boils down to one reply, and that is the district court got it right. The district court made appropriate findings based upon the record, based upon a stipulation of the parties, and based upon evidence that the parties agreed to prior to trial. There was a discussion, Your Honors, about the evidence that was going to be received and the fact that appellant received more documentation that was being submitted to the trial. I was very transparent and very upfront about that.
Was that discussion before the trial or after the trial?
It was before the trial, Your Honor. I am looking actually at the transcript and where I indicate as a pretrial issue that not all of the documents are in the exhibits. Additionally, the
what
court-
What page of the transcript is that, please?
Sure. The page of that transcript is on page 5, where I state our office provided Ms. Linney, Dr. Vaccarella, and Dr. Marshall more exhibits than what are actually submitted to the court. That is what I stated on the record.
So your position is she knew full well what was and wasn't going to the court prior to the court's receipt and decision?
Yes, she knew full well that she had more than what was being submitted. And additionally, respondent filed, we call it a document numerical index. It's several pages. It literally lists page by page with bait stamps numbers what is received and what is not. There's kind of a little table where there's an X for exhibit. If there's not an X, it's not in the exhibit.
And did she receive a copy of that annotation pre-trial?
Yes.
Ms. Jones, can you tell me, it appeared to me from the briefing that there was a point at which some records were pulled as being duplicative. Is that correct?
Yes. Records are if they are a duplicate, not just substance-wise, but literally a duplication, they are pulled. But in that table, that document index that I just mentioned, in the table, it will say, this isn't here, but you can find it in this other exhibit. So it's a roadmap. It tells you exactly where the documents are and what was not included in the exhibit.
So is it fair to say that the documents that you did not submit and indicated in the document numerical index were not included in the court exhibit? Is that part of our record? Can we look at, find out what those documents are? And more importantly, could opposing counsel do so?
As part of the motion for a new trial, I did give an example of what was not submitted as not being substantive. And that is part of the record. It was an exhibit to the motion for new trial. So this court can take a look at that, certainly.
But is the actual list of documents with the Bates stabs and X saying admitted or no X indicating it was admitted, is that part of the record?
Yes, Your Honor, that is part of the record.
Okay, and is that, what do you say to Ms. Lynn's argument that, well, all this was sealed, so she didn't have access to it after the trial? Is
we
that
did
accurate?
Have, yes, and I guess along those lines, additionally, I think this is one of the first cases where we used the Mendez system. And unfortunately, at that time, there wasn't a way to share. They've fixed that problem. So while I understand she doesn't have this perfectly packaged document, she does know what was submitted because it's been provided. I guess I never received a request saying, can you send me exactly what the court has? I didn't. That was not something that was requested of me, and I guess I don't know, because
but you're representing that you did provide a list, the court was aware of it, she had it, it listed every document that had been provided to appellant, and an X indicating that the document went in as part of the submission, and nothing that went in as part of the stipulation is a document that appellant had not seen or was not aware of.
Correct. And I guess as a general rule, if it has any substance and it's not a duplicate, it goes in. The court received a vast amount of documentation in these types of cases.
What do you say to appellant's argument that it was improper for the district court to make factual findings based on those documents because some were hearsay, some were not reliable?
So in commitment actions, it's a low threshold to what the court receives into evidence. The foundation doesn't have to be laid. Even reliable hearsay can be received based on the In re Williams and according to the Commitment and Treatment Act rules.
What I'm thinking, though, and I wonder if you've researched, is it seems odd to me that somebody would agree to stipulate to the existence of the ultimate issue, agree to stipulate to the admission of thousands of documents with no objections or qualifications other than it's got to be the same thing that was disclosed to me, and yet still try to raise objections to the fact finder's reliance on those documents. I'm wondering if the fact that you've stipulated to all of these documents means that you can't complain that the district court based findings on those documents.
I think that's a fair assessment. There was a stipulation, and so we didn't really focus on whether or not during the trial, whether or not appellant was a sexually dangerous person, because it was stipulated to, it was agreed to. However, the court does need to make specific findings in its order, and that has to be based on the records that the court received. Whether or not they're reliable would have been something that should have been raised at the time that the evidence was being submitted, at the time that the parties submitted or that respondents submitted Exhibit 1 through 27, and there was no objection to those being received and relied upon. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does.
Okay. Unless there are other questions about the procedural process used at the trial, I think I'll just move on to the less restrictive alternative. The district court got that right as well. The burden shifts to the appellant to show that there's a less restrictive alternative to treatment that's available, willing to accept her under commitment, meets her treatment needs, and assures for public safety. The availability, we don't even get past really the availability. It's not available from a legal perspective and a practical perspective. From a legal perspective, the underlying court cannot order appellant to remain in the Department of Corrections. That's a decision that's made by the Hearings and Release Unit. And similar to the Winsky decision that this court issued, in Winsky, the district court found that Winsky met criteria as being a sexually dangerous person, but sort of leapfrogged MSOP and said, you can go to the unsecure section of Minnesota Sex Offender Program to community preparations. You can't get there unless there's an order from a commitment appeal panel. Analogizing that to this situation, the district court can't order that a hearings and release unit extend appellant's sentence. Appellant had already been through that HRU process, the hearings and release unit process. The hearings and release unit had already extended that sentence and had already provided that treatment mandate. And that's what led to appellant being in treatment on two separate occasions, being terminated from that treatment within a very short period of time, not even making it through that assessment phase of treatment. And, you know, Ms. Linney talks about how she had reapplied. Semantically, that's not accurate. She had been terminated that second time, appealed that termination, and that appeal was denied. I think the record from the hearings and release unit maybe just got that word incorrect, but Ms. Ortman in her testimony made it clear that she had, and Ms. Ortman,
okay, I'm not hearing you. Is it just me?
No, I'm finding periodically there are some silences. They're brief, okay. But
I'm sorry, a little thing popped up and said the host muted you. So I thought maybe I missed a question.
I think that was accidental.
It's okay. just to back up a little bit, the hearings and release unit document that Ms. Linney talks about, I think used an incorrect word. Ms. Ortman from the Department of Corrections testified that appellant did appeal that second termination, and that appeal was denied, but she was told she could reapply within 60 days if she remained discipline free. And that is what didn't happen. She did not reapply. She testified directly on that point when she was questioned that, no, I did not reapply. I didn't feel safe. There was a shower situation that she did not feel safe about, and she did not reapply until a few days before the civil commitment trial. It is a stretch. If you read the hearings and release unit document, it is a stretch to say that because she was being considered for commitment that she was denied treatment. That's just not accurate. That's not what that document says, and there's no direct link to that whatsoever. So she was not denied treatment, but the treatment is no longer available at this point at the time of the civil commitment trial. It's not available because it's legally not available. The court can't order it, but also based on her own actions. As this court has pointed out, she had 9 years in the community. She tried CORE and she tried Project Pathfinders. And she kept getting terminated from those programs for having contact with minors, accessing pornography, basically not following the rules of treatment and her supervision. So after 9 years of that, the HRU, the Hearings and Release Unit, says, You're coming back in for 365 days. We're giving you a treatment mandate, and that's when we have the prison-based programming that she went into, was accepted into, but was terminated very quickly into her assessment phase, and terminated twice. So based on her own actions, her own inability to kind of get through programming, she's kind of has made any other opportunities unavailable to her. So it's not available. It is not, it's not, it anything less than the Minnesota Sex Offender Program would not treat her, or sorry, meet her treatment needs. Both examiners were very clear that she needs a high intensity level of treatment because her risk is high. She agreed that she meets criteria as being sexually dangerous. Part of that element of the definition is that she has a high likelihood of risk of reoffense. So we need to treat a high risk of reoffense with a high level of treatment, and that is found at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. So her treatment needs are with the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I see that I'm running low on time, and I would just indicate to this court that this district court carefully considered the motion for new trial, found there were no irregularities and no misconduct. I would simply conclude by requesting this court to affirm the decision below. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lenny, you have an opportunity for rebuttal argument.
Yes, Your Honor. So very briefly, at the beginning, you asked if I could cite to where it, I acknowledged that I didn't receive Exhibit 10. So if you look at page 3, line 19 through 21, I noted to the court that I hadn't received Exhibit 10. Then also, if you review our motion, Exhibit A, so page 15 of that motion, it actually, you have the email discussion where it was stated that the records are sealed, so we don't have access to them. So that's in the record where we kind of discussed that you asked for.
Could you respond to Ms. Jones' argument that regardless of all of that, at the pretrial stage, on record, it was discussed that respondent was submitting fewer documents than had been agreed under the stipulation, and that you were provided a list of all documents that were originally intended to be part of the stipulation with bait stamps identifying them, and with a mark which indicated whether or not each particular document had been submitted to the court.
I don't believe that. And so I believe if you look at it, I that kind of follows up. I very start with saying, hey, as long as they all agree. And I said, is that the case? And the court looked at her and said, if that's the case, she said, yes, that is the case. And she does make a comment of okay, that.
Also, only provided could you them just, did she provide you with a document list that listed every exhibit which had been disclosed and which was going to originally be submitted as part of the stipulation, but which showed through marks which exhibits were and were not actually submitted to the district court? Did you not receive that list?
No, it's like I know I received a list. I don't think I believe I received any sort of list that said, oh, by the way, we're not submitting pages this, 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 and this that I can recall. When I remember receiving a document index list, I remember receiving a document list. But no, I don't recall ever seeing anything about, oh, we're not including that. And I think that supports because the court admin was the one who reached out and said, hey, we're looking at your index list and you're missing pages here. We're looking at what you said you were supposed to be submitted to us on your witness and exhibit list, and they don't match up. And so that's really when everything came out. I do want to just address a couple more things, if that's okay, Your Honor, since I only have about 2 minutes left.
Of course.
So regarding the whole idea of what was stipulated to, again, the facts are there, but I think one of the things that really kind of addressed my client is that she acknowledges that she was convicted. And so really we go back on that. When you start going into and starting to prove things, which again was not discussed at trial, saying, again, a finding of fact that when she was a minor, That she was attacking her brothers and her sisters. And I think, and that's really what, and that was never discussed at trial. Basically, at trial, we basically said, yeah, I've been convicted of three rapes. And so arguably that's going to be enough for me to meet some of these initial criteria. And then later, what ended up happening is they started shoehorning in a bunch of other facts that really aren't relevant, that were never discussed. And I think, and that's where this comes to the frustration of that, is when we kind of stipulated to that, we didn't need to go into all this thing or to bring up things that my client, because if we would have known that they were going to try and say that you're going to have a finding that you attacked your brothers and sisters according to your mom when you were younger, we would have addressed that at court. We would have said no more challenge.
Isn't the finding just that? Her mother reported that she did this, as opposed to she did this.
And but that's the problem by saying that, but that's not what it says. When you read that in a court, like in an order from this, it reads as if this is what happened. That the court believes that my client attacked her siblings while she was younger by putting that finding of fact into this. It's not just about report, because you're not going to put it in there if the court didn't find it relevant, if
okay.
the court didn't find
Counsel,
mom believable.
if the finding were removed, what changes for your client? She's
For
still
my client.
committed, and she's still stipulated that she meets the criteria for commitment.
Because she doesn't want somebody to go through and read this and think that she's attacking her siblings when it never happened. That's what it changes. It's in mean, the
but
whole
counsel,
respect thing.
I thought the record is sealed. So who's reading this?
Well, no, the record is sealed. The order is, you can get access to the order, I believe. And so that's the thing. And just the idea that people think that this is what happened. And that's kind of one of the issues she's had all of her life. People kind of, like I said, people, she, her mom has lied about her all her life. So for her, it's personal. And that's really kind of one of the things. Very finally, I kind of want to address, I think Kinsey, the whole idea of Kinsey and whether or not the person is allowed, I think that was addressed in my original point where I pointed out where this is why Kinsey was overruled. Notably, all the cases she cited are before they renumbered the statute. The statute was not simply renumbered. It was changed. So it's not the same statute that existed before they separated them all. And then finally, our appeals arguments are different. We're not saying that you can't do this. Our argument is that the court should have more say to basically be able to say that the party can't do this, that they have to go to SOP, Minnesota SOP. That means it's like without the court having any sort of authority, when the examiners have said, no, treatment in prison would satisfy her needs. It would satisfy the need for public safety, and it would satisfy the need for treatment. And so when you can meet those requirements, but do it under less restrictive, then that's kind of the issue of the constitutionality, Your Honor.
I understand that. And to be honest with you, the first time I tried one of these cases as a district court judge, the question I asked Matthew Frank, then attorney, now judge, was, what's this guy doing here? He's got 7 years left on his sentence. Why are we doing a commitment process? And because I was thinking, what you're arguing, it seems like you should stay in prison, serve your sentence, do your treatment there. But I found nothing in the law that says the district court has the ability to order the Department of Corrections to keep somebody in prison and receive treatment there as opposed to pursuing civil commitment. And I'm not seeing any authority for that outcome in your brief. What is your best authority you can cite for the proposition that a district court is allowed to order the DOC to keep somebody in prison and let them receive treatment there, and to not allow that violates the Constitution?
I think the best authority is I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me, but in my brief, I cite the statute that says when there's a dual commitment, the preference, the DOC basically gets first dibs on it. Like the DOC
doesn't that tell us what we're hearing, which is once the district court commits somebody to the DOC, I think the law is very clear. The district court no longer has control or authority over that person. The DOC does. So why should the district court be able to say in this context, no DOC, you can't refer him for sex offender commitment or her? And once your client admits that she meets the criteria for commitment as a sexually dangerous person, by what authority does she get to say, but you need to let me go back to prison? I mean, the whole idea of commitment is it's instead of remaining in prison.
So, and I think, and that's kind of the issue when you have dual commitment, because you have cases in the past where they have stayed in prison and they have been committed and they've received treatment in prison. That's why I was so thrilled when they said we can't treat people once they've been committed. But I think what the statutes basically clearly line up is to say that in here it's a dual commitment. We allow for dual commitment. We allow you to be both committed to the Department of Corrections and the Department of
But who gets to make that choice? Isn't it the Department of Corrections ultimately who has control and authority over the committed person as
So
long as they're in prison?
I think the statute basically says is that when they're committed with both, they're supposed to stay with the Department of Corrections.
Which statute says that? Is that statute cited in your brief?
I believe so, Your Honor. I
All right.
believe I did.
I will look for it and we'll see if it's there.
Okay. All
All
right.
right. That concludes the arguments. Thank you both for your briefing and your patience with our questions. We will take the matter under advisement and have our decision to you within 90 days.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.